The world and everything in it is made possible in part by ChristianBook.com, the web's largest selection of Christian books, Bibles, gifts, music, and more.
And by world members, as well as the generous support of our world movers. WNG.org/donate.
Good morning. The Supreme Court hears from terror victims who seek damages from an overseas bank with a branch here. And when you plead guilty, does that mean you forever give up the right to appeal?
And I thought the rule is simply this. When you say guilty, you have admitted you did what the statute forbids. But what you haven't admitted is that the statute is a valid statute.
That's ahead on Legal Docket, also the Monday Money Beat, the World Radio History Book, and a commentary from Andre Sue Peterson.
I asked a few people if they'd ever forgiven anyone and what it felt like. They gave me answers so pious I knew they'd never done it.
It's Monday, October 23rd. This is The World and Everything in It from World Radio. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Good morning.
Up next, Jim Henry with today's news.
Police and the FBI are actively searching for an apparent serial killer who has taken three lives in a Tampa, Florida neighborhood. Interim Tampa Police Chief Brian Dugan says investigators have no leads or suspects.
We don't know if this is one individual. We don't know their color. We don't know the race, their ethnicity, their sex. There's so many unknowns.
The suspect has shot and killed three people within 10 blocks of each other over a period of 10 days. Two of the victims were African-American males, the third a white female. Police say the only similarity among the victims is that they were all walking alone at night. Maria Rodriguez, mother of one of the victims, is asking neighbors to help police catch the killer.
As a community, if someone knows something, step up. Please step up. Say something.
Police are offering a $25,000 reward for information leading to the Tampa killer's arrest. They've urged Tampa residents not to travel alone at night. Nearly a half million protesters on the streets of Barcelona Saturday after the Spanish government announced plans to replace Catalonia's separatist leaders and call a new regional election. After a special cabinet session, Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy said he wants the Senate to approve central government ministers to take over police, finances, and public media in Catalonia. He also promised the region would retain its autonomy and elect its own officials within 6 months. Catalans who support independence balked at the announcement, calling the move a coup d'etat by a totalitarian Spanish central government. Catalan leader Carles Puigdemont called Rajoy's move incompatible with the rule of law.
Perquè imposar una forma de govern no escollida pels ciutadans.
Puigdemont has threatened to hold a vote in the regional parliament for an explicit declaration of independence from Spain. The region voted for independence in a disputed October 1st referendum. The U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington has weighed in on an immigration case brought by a teenaged, unauthorized immigrant suing the government to get an abortion. World Radio's Kent Covington has more.
After stopping a 17-year-old girl in government custody from getting an abortion last week, an appeals court has ruled that she can end the life of her baby. However, the court says the government does not have to facilitate it by transporting her to get one. Instead, the court wants her released to a sponsor, such as a relative in the U.S., by the end of the month. If that does not happen, she'll be allowed to continue her court case against the government. The girl is now 15 weeks pregnant. She illegally entered the United States in September as an unaccompanied minor before learning she was pregnant. After the ruling, federal health officials said in the statement that for however much time they're given, they will protect the well-being of this minor and all children and their babies and their facilities. I'm Kent Covington.
More details are emerging about the allegations of sexual harassment against former Fox News host Bill O'Reilly. O'Reilly settled a series of sexual harassment complaints out of court before Fox News gave him a 4-year contract extension worth $25 million a year. The New York Times is now reporting that O'Reilly settled one complaint with former Fox analyst Lise Wiehl for $32 million just a month before Fox renewed his contract last February. That complaint contained allegations of repeated harassment, a non-consensual sexual relationship, and sending pornography to Wiehl. The network fired O'Reilly in April after some of the complaints became public. 6 months earlier, Fox fired its chairman, Roger Ailes, for sexual harassment complaints. At the box office this weekend, Tyler Perry's Boo 2, A Madea Halloween, took the top spot.
Are you crazy?
It's going to be super creepy and scary. That's why it's going to be lit.
I'm so excited.
Do you believe this? 14 murders?
Why would they want to go to a party where people have been murdered?
The PG-13 Boo 2 debut, scaring up $20 million in ticket sales. Second place went to PG-13 Geostorm, debuting with $13 million. Get World's reviews of current films along with ratings and content information at wng.org/movies. I'm Jim Henry. Straight ahead, when is a plea bargain not the end of the case? That's next on Legal Docket. Plus commentary from Andre Sue Peterson. This is The World and Everything in It.
If you're still browsing for Christian items online at a secular retailer, it's time you visited ChristianBook.com. With more than 500,000 products to choose from, we're the web's largest selection of everything Christian, always at the best value. You'll find everything books and Bibles, everything gifts and music, everything homeschool, VBS, and more, all in one place, and always from people who share your values. ChristianBook.com. Everything Christian for less.
From member-supported World Radio, this is The World and Everything in It for October 23rd. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Nick Eicher. The U.S. Supreme Court is on break from oral arguments until the end of the month. Today, analysis of two cases. They come from among the first block of arguments heard in the first 2 weeks. Up first, the case of retired military veteran Rodney Class. This case goes back to 2008, when Class drove his Jeep from North Carolina to the nation's capital. He had come to enjoy a tour of the House and Senate buildings. When he arrived in Washington, he found a parking spot about 1,000 feet from the Capitol building. Mindful that he could not bring his weapons along, Class stowed his firearms in the vehicle, three of them, all lawfully owned, registered, and out of sight. To his mind, everything was okay.
Except it wasn't. Federal law prohibits weapons within the grounds of the Capitol. While Class was touring, police noticed the out-of-state license plates and peered inside, where they saw an empty gun holster. When Class returned to the vehicle, police confronted him. He readily admitted weapons were in his Jeep and told police he had a concealed carry permit and lawfully owned the guns.
But that's when police arrested Class, citing federal law banning weapons near the Capitol. Eventually, Class and prosecutors would enter into a plea bargain where Class would plead guilty to possessing readily accessible firearms on Capitol grounds. He had to go to jail for 24 days, he had to pay a fine, and he received 12 months of supervised release.
Despite pleading guilty, Class appealed on grounds that the statute he pled guilty to is not itself valid under the Constitution. He argues the Second Amendment allows citizens to possess firearms. The government responds that the appeal comes too late. A guilty plea is a guilty plea, and a deal is a deal. That means Class waived his right to appeal. Listen to lawyer Eric Fagan on behalf of the government.
Case, we dropped a failure to appear charge in return for the plea agreement here. There's a serious information imbalance here. Only the defendant knows what kinds of claims he might want to bring after a guilty plea and in what respects he doesn't intend his guilty plea to be final.
Class's lawyer, Jessica Amundson, argued a plea deal involving guns puts the burden on government prosecutors to be very specific when crafting the language of the deal.
And so our contention here is not that these claims cannot be waived. Our contention here is that they were not explicitly waived in the plea agreement, and they were not otherwise forfeited by operation of the plea itself.
Justice Samuel Alito worried about undoing thousands of cases thought over and done with after a plea agreement concludes the case. So while Class argues he has a constitutional right to possess a firearm, the question before the Supreme Court is more narrow. That is, when you plead guilty, what claims are you giving up if you want to appeal? Justice Stephen Breyer deconstructed admissions of guilt.
When you say guilty, you have admitted you did what the statute forbids. Okay, so let's go look at the statute. See what it forbids. And you admit you did it. Now that means you're waiving all the claims that the evidence wasn't good enough, that they should have excluded something under the Fifth Amendment, that somebody shouldn't have testified under the Fourth Amendment, under the Fifth. You admit you did what the statute forbids. But what you haven't admitted is that the statute, for example, is a valid statute. You haven't admitted that.
Justice Elena Kagan carried that idea further. Listen to her address government lawyer Fagan, who warned a flood of criminal appeals will inundate the court system should Rodney Class prevail.
It's awfully hard to say that the floodgates are opening when it's in the power of every U.S. attorney to just write this into the plea agreement.
Lest you think only the liberal-leaning justices were tipping their hats toward Rodney Class, listen to conservative-leaning Justice Neil Gorsuch.
I look to history to start with, and it's suggesting that not only is it you're not admitting even to what the statute says. You're admitting to what's in the indictment. And isn't that maybe the most natural and historically consistent understanding of what a guilty plea is? I plead guilty to that which I am charged. What's in the indictment?
Rodney Class probably feels his chances to win on this issue are good, and I agree. Underlying the justices' questions and comments is acknowledgement that there is a power differential between the powerless citizen and the powerful government. So it makes sense to require the government to craft plea bargains that make crystal clear what the citizen is giving up in a deal. Most crimes are solved through plea bargains. They're central to our criminal justice system, and that's the bigger issue in this case. My second case today arises from terror attacks that happened in Israel. 6,000 survivors and family members sued Arab Bank, based in Jordan, but with a branch office in New York City. And that's the hook. Lawyer Jeffrey Fisher represented the terror victims.
What we allege is knowing and purposeful financing of terrorism with the expectation that it will make those terrorism attacks more successful and more lucrative for the perpetrators. And that is a violation of the law of nations.
The federal law in question is the Alien Tort Statute. In a moment, you'll hear Justice Kagan refer to it by the initialism ATS. The statute says U.S. courts can hear cases that involve foreigners for, quote, violations of the law of nations or a treaty of the U.S. Adopted by the very first Congress back in 1789, the law was pretty much ignored for centuries. More recently, though, the Supreme Court opened the door to some claims under the ATS, but it's never answered the basic question of whether corporations, not individuals, can be sued for violating some international norm. Arab Bank's lawyer, Paul Clement, argued against making corporations liable, particularly under the facts of this case.
This case arises out of a suit by Israeli nationals against a corporation chartered in Jordan for injuries suffered in Israel and the adjoining territories. Now, there are a host of problems with this lawsuit, not the least of which is there is nothing approaching a specific, universal, obligatory norm under international law that imposes obligations directly on corporations.
There is no such thing as a well-defined international norm, he argued. So courts have no business stating what that is to impose liability on companies. But Justice Kagan wasn't so sure about that.
And so just assume a different lawsuit. So the defendant is an American corporation, and it uses slave labor of people in the United States of a particular nationality. And the country from which these people come thinks that this is a pretty awful thing. And you're saying that there shouldn't be ATS liability against the corporation in that circumstance, even though they are using slave labor, clearly violating an international norm, and even though this is a case in which the other country thinks, who cares if it's a corporation? We want our people to be able to recover.
Clement, ever quick on his feet, countered that suing individuals within a corporation is just fine. But corporate liability in matters of foreign terror, no such precedent. But what if those individuals are poor, Justice Kagan wondered. Clement had an answer.
They happen not to have very much money.
But, well, actually, people who work, especially in management positions and corporations, tend to have a fair amount of money. And so I think you are in that scenario, in your hypothetical, you're going to find plenty of deep-pocketed defendants.
But Fisher, for the terror victims, reminded the High Court of its own rulings about the nature of corporations.
Because that is at the heart of the notion of corporate personhood. What the court has said time and again is that part of the corporate bargain is that you get privileges and opportunities, but you also have burdens of being held liable in tort actions.
And so, logically, that should mean Arab Bank has corporate liability to his terror victim clients. Chief Justice John Roberts had other concerns.
I'm concerned about the foreign entanglement issue. I mean, we passed this statute to avoid foreign entanglements because we wanted to provide a forum for someone like the French ambassador and the Longchamp affair. But I'm wondering if extending it to corporate liability is, in fact, going to have the same problematic result of increasing our entanglements as it obviously has here with respect to the government of Jordan.
Justice Breyer pointed out that corporations are liable under some international treaties, so why not make corporations liable under the facts of this case? Arab Banks, Clement.
There are six treaties that purport to do that. All six of those treaties impose civil corporate liability directly under international law. What is so telling about those six treaties is that the United States has signed exactly none of them.
Other facts favor the bank here. For example, every customer account at issue was a foreign one. The New York branch did not hold even one of the bank accounts in question. The bank processed the transactions electronically, not with people making decisions about the money, so the connection to the U.S. would seem quite tenuous. The terror victims, though, say it's enough that the New York branch administered many of the payments, and underlying their argument is that under U.S. law, bigger damages are possible. Based on the justice's comments, this looks like a split ruling, and Justice Anthony Kennedy, again, the swing vote. And that's this week's Legal Docket.
School officials had to order the evacuation of a parochial high school earlier this month when an unpleasant odor wafted through the hallways.
What is that smell? Oh!
Fire and hazmat crews rushed to the scene at the school, where students and teachers reported feeling nauseated. Despite the reports, fire officials determined the odor was harmless. Their careful investigation turned up the source of the problem, a plug-in air freshener, pumpkin spice to be exact. Classes could not resume until the next day at Cristo Rey Jesuit High School in Baltimore. It's the world and everything in it.
You're busy and on the move. Time's short, but you want to stay in touch with the news that matters most. You need clarity that's instant and easy to get to. You also want to share big ideas and updates in real time with others. Stories you know will make a difference in their lives. That's what World Digital does best. Get you the story instantly and makes it easily shareable with others. World Digital, your fast lane for staying informed about the truly important news of the day on Twitter, Facebook, or WNG.org.
It's the world and everything in it from member-supported World Radio. Today is Monday, October 23rd. Good morning. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Nick Eicher. It's time now for the Monday Money Beat. House Speaker Paul Ryan says the tax plan pushed by President Trump and Republican leaders will add a fourth tax bracket for the highest income people. The original idea had been to pare back the current seven brackets to three. About that fourth bracket, Ryan told CBS this morning he and his colleagues are working on what that rate would be. Meantime, the Senate's approval last week of a $4 trillion budget sets the stage for Republicans to rework the federal tax code. Now, with a House and Senate version, Republicans are free to approve new tax legislation without Democrats having the chance to block it. Now that tax reform is one step closer to reality, Wall Street set more new records last week.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average hit its 53rd record close for the year. According to the Wall Street Journal, the index now has set the most records in a calendar year in more than two decades. For the week, the Dow was up 2 full percentage points. That's the biggest gain since mid-September. Both the NASDAQ and the Standard & Poor's 500 also notched weekly gains and set new records.
President Trump is signaling now that he is considering dual nominations for the Federal Reserve's top two jobs. Trump may appoint as chairman Jerome Powell to replace current Fed chair Janet Yellen. Powell is currently a member of the Fed's board. And as vice chairman, the president said to be looking at Stanford University economist John Taylor. Yellen's four-year term as Fed chair ends in February. Trump broke the news in an interview Friday with Fox Business.
U.S. home sales rose slightly last month, but still a shortage of available homes is limiting sales to many would-be buyers. The National Association of Realtors says existing home sales increased 0.7%. That's the first increase after 3 months of declines, and it comes as the Houston housing market quickly recovered from the effects of Hurricane Harvey.
By the way, there's a new tally not just for Harvey's cost, but Hurricanes Irma and Maria, as well as two recent earthquakes in Mexico. According to one of the world's biggest reinsurers, the Zurich-based Swiss Re, all those disasters will cost the industry a staggering $95 billion. The company provides backup policies to companies that write primary insurance policies, and it adds the claims process is ongoing and its $95 billion estimate could evolve.
And that is this week's Money Beat. Next up on The World and Everything in It, the World Radio History Book.
Today, a powerful lawyer becomes counselor to Henry VIII, the birth of religious dissent during the Vietnam War, and the 15th anniversary of a Russian hostage situation in Moscow. Paul Butler has the details.
We begin today on October 26, 1529. Catholic lawyer Thomas More becomes Lord Chancellor of England. The position is primarily judicial, hearing weighty cases that don't require the monarch's direct oversight. But as the second highest-ranking minister in the king's court, the Lord Chancellor is also a crucial advisor in both spiritual and governing matters. He strongly opposes the Protestant Reformation. He calls Luther, Tyndale, and others heretics in his public writings, and says the Reformation is a threat to the unity of both church and society.
I cannot condone this newfangled vision of private belief and personal grace. For me, the church is the permanent and living sign of God's presence. It is a visible, palpable community, not just a few brethren gathered in secret rooms.
A scene from a 2008 episode of the Showtime drama, The Tudors. Fox's Book of Martyrs portrays Lord Chancellor More as overseeing a number of publicized persecutions and taking part in the torture and burning of so-called Protestant heretics. But as King Henry VIII and the Catholic Church spar over divorce, More resigns as Lord Chancellor after just 3 years. He refuses to acknowledge the king as the head of the English Church, and he also openly opposes Henry VIII's divorce and remarriage to Anne Boleyn, which leads to his eventual execution on July 6, 1535. The Catholic Church canonized More as a saint in 1935, 400 years after his death. Next, October 27, 1967, 50 years ago this week. Catholic priest Philip Berrigan and three other protesters forced their way into government offices at the Customs House in Baltimore, Maryland. They open a file drawer and pour a mixture of animal and their own human blood over Selective Service records to protest America's involvement in the Vietnam War. 7 months later, Berrigan, his brother Daniel, and a handful of nuns and Vietnam veterans walk into a draft board office and forcibly remove files.
We regret very much, I think all of us, the inconvenience and even the suffering that we brought to these clerks here. It was done so quickly, and we had hoped that they wouldn't be so excitable over a few files.
In the parking lot, they ignite the records with homemade napalm and destroy 600 files, preventing many men from being drafted. The two events spark more than 100 similar draft office protests across the nation. They also bring people of faith into the anti-war movement. And finally, 15 years ago today, October 23rd, 2002, Chechen terrorists seize the House of Culture Theater in Moscow taking more than 800 theatergoers and actors hostage.
Suddenly, masked gunmen invaded the stage mid-song. Female suicide bombers surrounded the crowd. They said it would take them a fraction of a second to set off a chain of explosions that would kill the entire audience and cast.
The next day, one of the hostages, a woman, emerges from the theater with a message for the Russian government and world leaders. She says that if the standoff isn't solved peacefully, the terrorists claim they will spill much blood. Over the next few days, many well-known Russians attempt negotiations with the rebels. A television crew is allowed in for an interview with Movsar Barayev, the group's leader. Barayev demands Russia withdraw from Chechnya and bring an end to the Second Chechen War. On the morning of October 26th, Russian special forces used the ventilation system to fill the theater with an aerosol anesthetic. When the soldiers storm the theater an hour later, the firefight lasts 30 minutes. When it's over, approximately 50 Chechen rebels are dead. Though no hostages are killed in the gunfire, more than 100 die of gas poisoning in the hours following. That's this week's World Radio History Book. I'm Paul Butler.
You get it. You value honest journalism. That's why you listen to and read World. We share stories in light of God's big story of redemption, truth tempered with hope. And we couldn't do what we do without the generous partners we call World Movers. Membership fees only cover half of production costs, so we depend on donors to close the gap. If you believe in World's mission, would you give a gift today to help others get it? WNG.org/worldmovers.
Today is Monday, October 23rd. Good morning. This is The World and Everything in It from member-supported World Radio. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Have you thought much about forgiveness? Not about receiving it, but about giving it. That is the thinking part. Here now is World's Andre Sue Peterson on the doing part.
Forgiving is the hardest thing you will ever do. That's why most people don't do it. We talk about it, cheer for it, preach on it, and are sure we've practiced it, but mostly the illusion of having forgiven is that the passage of time dulls our memory. I asked a few people if they'd ever forgiven anyone and what it felt like. They gave me answers so pious I knew they'd never done it. I'm at the present moment in the maw of temptation, and I can tell you there is nothing exalted about this feeling, this 1-2 punch to the gut that comes when you even contemplate forgiving, which is as far as I've come. At first, I decided I would forgive the person and never speak to him again. That felt pretty good, but I saw the dissimulation in it at once. I alternately toyed with going to him, quote, to show him his fault, which is my biblical right, so there. I had the rebuke written up in my head, a document of meticulous detail, all for his own good. A self-righteous satisfaction accompanied the plan, so I nixed it, for now. Keeping one's mouth shut is commendable and more than I have managed in the past. It will work as long as I don't go near a phone or email. But I am reminded that, quote, Absalom spoke to Amnon neither good nor bad, end of quote, for 2 whole years after the rape of his sister Tamar, and it ate him alive until in the end he killed the man. Forgiveness is a brutal mathematical transaction done with fully engaged faculties. It is my pain instead of yours. I eat the debt. I absorb the misery I wanted to dish out on you, and you go scot-free. Beware the forgiveness that is tendered soon after the injury. Real forgiveness needs a time lag, for it is wrought in private agony before it ever comes to public amnesty. All true acts of courage are thus done in secret. And now the unthinkable, not only to forgive the person, but to seek his good. Nature abhors a vacuum, and Jesus admits of no middle ground between hate and love. Pray for him. When you were a child, you thought like a child, that pain was something to flee. Now, in the adulthood of faith, suck up your 100 denarii, because someone took your 10,000 talents upon himself, and like a lamb led to slaughter and a sheep before its shearers was silent, he did not retaliate, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. Be so awash in the ocean of his love, my soul, that the shortcomings of all human loves will more and more seem but a trifling thing. For World Radio, I'm Andre Sue Peterson.
Thank you for listening today. Here is what we're working on for the Tuesday program. That speech by former President George W. Bush that so many are talking about, we are editing together about 7 minutes of the key excerpts. And the Me Too social media campaign. Sarah Schweinsberg's working on a report. That and more tomorrow. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Mary Reichard. The world and everything in it comes to you from World Radio, part of World, a member-supported nonprofit news team committed to biblically objective journalism that informs, educates, and inspires. This program is made possible by World members and by the generous support of our World Movers. Your gifts do matter, and we're thankful for them. WNG.org/donate. Well, that wraps up our program for Monday, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.